Thank you, Duncan. My brief is to talk about the Australian economy and the outlook. Ahmed stolen a little bit of my thunder, so I've got the PowerPoint slides that I'll walk through, but some of them I'll walk through a little bit more quickly than others, given that Ahmed has covered some of the issues. The bottom line, I guess, is that unusually for two economists, I agree with Ahmed's basic point that I think the current environment in Australia is very positive. The outlook for the economy is generally very good. The economy is in a good state right at the moment. Like Ahmed, I see that there are a number of risks. Some of the risks that I see are basically the same risks that Ahmed has already discussed. There is one issue that Ahmed alluded to that I disagree with. I wouldn't be two economists without some kind of disagreement. And that's the issue of the inflation risk. Ahmed was saying that there is a risk of inflation in the sort of forecast horizon. I don't see any significant risk of inflation in the sort of immediate future in the next 2, 3, 4 years. And I'll talk a little bit about why I see that as being the case. Certainly the other risks, things like avian flu, clearly are a risk, although in that case I'm not quite so sure how we would have any idea of how big a risk that is. It's just too much of an unknown. So I'll talk about some of those things as we go through. Let me begin just by running through the state of the Australian economy. These are the quarterly GDP numbers with year-over-year growth for the Australian economy since 2000. Relative to the rest of the OECD countries, the Australian economy has been doing very well in the double O's. Averaging growth in the 3-4% range, much better performance than pretty much any other OECD country, including the US. We didn't have the recession in 2001 that the US and most other OECD and certainly G7 countries had. And the performance since the recession of 2001 has also been very strong. Interestingly, in sort of looking at Australia and the US, we're essentially a couple of years ahead of where the US is, I think. The US is now still probably midway through the housing cycle, whereas we have had a flat period of a couple of years in housing prices. And I think that affects some of the sort of relative risks in looking at the Australian versus the US economy. That risk has diminished in Australia, the housing price risk. It's still a risk in the US. Ahmed had a slide on that, which he didn't put up. But I think that's one of a number of reasons why I think the Australian economy is currently sitting very nicely. The December quarter national accounts are due out next week. The latest quarter data that I have on the slide here is for the September quarter last year. The year-over-year growth was 2.6% GDP growth for the year to September, so slightly below the sort of long-term average. But as Ahmed was pointing out, the sort of structure of the GDP growth was quite positive. A lot of the growth driven by strength in business investment. We've seen a sort of levelling off on our trade deficit side, and consumption growth hasn't been continuing to grow so strongly. And that's a positive, unless you're a retailer or someone like that, I guess. It's a positive in the sense that I think our consumption pattern is now on a much more stable footing than was the case 2 or 3 years ago, where our savings rate was not only negative but becoming more negative each quarter and each year. So where I see this graph going over the course of the next few years is, or next 12 months or 18 months, is back towards 3%, basically a similar forecast for GDP as what Ahmed was alluding to. On the employment side, the unemployment rate has edged up in the latest numbers. So the January numbers are the latest ones we have. 5.3% up from 5.1% a year ago. Obviously, that's not a good sort of direction to be going in. But the movements in the employment front are not that large, given that we've had relatively low GDP growth in the last 12 months. Looking forward, with GDP growth expected to be nearer to normal, I wouldn't see unemployment heading very far in either direction away from the current level of sort of 5 to 5.5%. That's a pretty strong performance for an OECD-type economy. Certainly there are ways that we could get that unemployment rate lower, but I think that's a fairly strong performance on the employment front, and no reason to see that deteriorating in the near future. As we know, in this state, the unemployment performance has been very good, for going from a situation where 5, 10, 15 years ago, the unemployment rate was typically 1 to 2% above the national average, to today, where the number for the January month was that unemployment, seasonally adjusted, was 5% in South Australia, compared with 5.3% for the national average. And there's been a bit of a there's been some strong shifts in the national data, in the state data, nationally in the last few years. Obviously, Western Australia and Queensland now significantly growing much more strongly than the Australian economy more generally. The weaker states on the employment and the unemployment front are New South Wales and Victoria. So New South Wales having unemployment rate of 5.7%. So South Australia and Tasmania are no longer the laggards, or so far behind in the case of Tasmania, as 2 or 3 years ago. On the inflation and interest rate front, the inflation rate in Australia has been quite remarkable in the past decade, in the past 13 years. It was 1993 that the Reserve Bank said we are going to try and target inflation in the blue range there, the 2 to 3% range. And interestingly, they're very careful with their wording. The European Central Bank says we want to keep inflation always below 2%. The wording of the Reserve Bank Act, the Reserve Bank uses, is, I think, much more careful and much more sensible. They say we want to keep inflation in the 2 to 3% range on average over the cycle. And if you talk to people at the Reserve Bank, what they say is, if we look back over a 5 to 10 year period, what we want to see is an average inflation rate with a 2 in front of it. And they don't care if inflation goes to 1% or to 4% or to 5%, as long as the average is sticking around 2 to 3%. Despite the fact that they're quite willing to accept inflation outside that 2 to 3% range, through most of the past decade, we haven't seen inflation outside that range, with the exception of the GST introduction and the brief sort of period of below 2% inflation in the Asian crisis period and subsequent to the Asian crisis period. So this fact that over the last 5 years, inflation has always been in the Reserve Bank's 2 to 3% range is quite remarkable. It's a very impressive performance. And, of course, what that means is that with the sort of natural rate of interest being about 3 to 4% above the inflation rate, that interest rates should stay in this range of 5 to 6, perhaps a little bit more than 6%, if we continue to see that kind of performance. What that means for monetary policy, core inflation right now is 2.5%. The headline inflation rate's a little bit above that because of oil prices. Going forward, I expect to see inflation continuing to be around this 2 to 3% sort of range. There's nothing to me that indicates that inflation will be rising anytime in the future. This is the announcement after the February board meeting by the Reserve Bank. Great job being on the Reserve Bank board, or being the governor of the Reserve Bank, because this is all you have to do once a month, write that sentence down and you're done. That's all he's going to do, as far as I see it, for the rest of this year. He does have to make a couple of statements to Parliament, but that seems to me to be a pretty good job. So that's what I would expect to see in the coming 12 months. Let's move to the United States. I think the United States is on much more fragile ground for a number of reasons, and I'll just talk about a couple of issues with the US economy. This is in the graphs here, the latest GDP numbers that are available for the US. We do have the fourth quarter data for the US. The fourth quarter GDP growth for the US showed a significant slowdown in growth, and that's the on the left-hand panel there, the dip there in the right-hand side of the graph. The 2005 GDP growth wasn't too bad for the full year. GDP growth was just above 3%, above the long-term average for the US, but it was underpinned by a number of factors which are clearly unsustainable. First of all, their consumption growth is still being underpinned by very strong house price growth, exactly the sort of thing that we saw in Australia in 2002-2003. Very strong house price growth, leading to lots of mortgage redrawals, leading to lots of spending, leading to a very low savings rate. All stuff that retailers love, but not a very sort of sustainable long-term way of generating growth in an economy. Another factor, which turns out to have been very important in the US economy in 2005, was very strong sales and growth in the motor vehicle sector of the economy. Motor vehicles are a very important part of the US economy. in, I think it was April, certainly early 2005, GM started to offer employee discounts to all of their customers. And the employee discounts in the car market are quite significant. You get a great deal on the car and you're basically paying less than cost. Now, they started to offer that to all of their customers in April, and they followed it with such a success on the sales front that they repeated the trick in May and, I think, June. Other car producers and sellers in the US were forced to follow suit with these huge price reductions in their car sales. Now, the problem with that is GM was selling cars at less than cost. And this is great for sales, but it's not clearly not a sustainable long-term plan. And the US GDP growth that you see there through the second and third quarter of 2005 is very much underpinned by strong consumption growth, consumption growth, and strong motor vehicle sales. That's clearly not going to happen in the future, and clearly there are major issues at the moment with GM in particular. So in the fourth quarter, what we did see was a marked slowdown in consumer spending, and in particular, a slowdown in motor vehicle demand. I think the consumption side, the fact that consumption is being underpinning the US economy, is something that's a real risk to the US economy. I think that as consumption slows, there's nothing rising to pick up the slack there. There's not the growth in investment that we've seen in Australia. And the trade deficit is also not heading in the right direction in the United States. If I had a little bit more time, I'd talk more about this. But the problem in the US with the trade deficit is one of political will. The trade deficit in the US is driven by a very high level of demand within the US economy. It's demand coming from consumers, for the reasons I've just alluded to, and it's demand coming from the government. The fact that the government is running very large deficits is meaning that they're pumping money and spending into the economy. And the bottom line is the US economy can't produce enough to match that demand, which is why they have a trade deficit. As I'll point out in a moment, the US trade deficit's almost nothing to do with China. It's all to do with internal demand. So that's another sort of feature of the US economy which is clearly unsustainable. They can't have the size trade deficits. They can't have the direction of trade deficits all being sort of to head south, continuing on into the future. And the problem with the US is that there's a real political unwillingness to tackle these issues. The budget deficit has come in lower in the last numbers than in previous years, but it seems it's more through good luck than through good management. And still the budget deficit, the government's deficit, is over $300 billion on the latest numbers. For 2006-07, I don't see the US economy falling over, but I can't see it growing at above 3% rates as we've seen in the last couple of years, simply because I can't see the consumption trends continuing to go the way that they've gone. So I do see a sort of softening towards more like the 2% GDP growth level in the US, and that's consistent with the fourth quarter numbers for the US. On the risk side for the US, housing prices do remain a risk. This problem that if house prices do fall by 20-odd percent, that can lead to significant falls in consumption growth and significant dampening of the economy overall. Interestingly, both Greenspan and the now current Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke have argued that there are only localized sort of bubbles in the US housing market. So they're certainly aware that there are potential issues here, but they're convinced that the house price issue in the US is not a major one. And Bernanke has stated repeatedly that in any event, the Fed should not do anything about housing price bubbles, even if they perceive them to be there. So there are some risks to the US economy. This slide's screwed up a little bit, but the inflation story for the US. The US doesn't have an inflation target, but interestingly, they do the same things that Australia does, and their inflation rate has been pretty similar to ours over the last few years. More recent numbers for the US, headline inflation numbers have been a little bit on the high side, in the 3-4% range, but their core inflation is also very close to this sort of 2.5% number that's now the inflation rate for Australia. The Fed fund rate, the sort of standard equivalent to the cash rate in the US, in Australia, in the US, is currently 4.5%. That's risen 25 basis points at every meeting since two or three years ago, from 1% to 4.5%. The futures market is pricing in another rate increase at the next Fed meeting, which I think is March 27, and another increase by the end of the year. So the US interest rates we would expect to see rising to 5% by year end. It's not clear when the second rate increase will occur, but most likely sometime in the middle to the end of the year. So US interest rates will continue to rise, but they're not going to continue to rise by 25 basis points at each meeting from here on in. Let me talk briefly about Japan, still our largest trading partner, an economy that's essentially been in a rut since 1990. Many people have been pointing, Armin mentioned the number, but he's not here, so I can say he got it a bit wrong. He was saying that Japanese GDP growth for the last quarter was about 3%. In fact, annualized, it was 5.6%. They had 1.4% GDP growth in their December quarter. Very good number for any OECD economy. Year-over-year growth was 4.1%. Things are looking a lot better for the Japanese economy. Koizumi is is keen to continue reforms to the Japanese economy. He, having called an election on the back of a reform that he wanted to do, now has a mandate to push through those reforms. So I'm sort of mildly optimistic that the Japanese economy may have finally turned the corner. But I do think that, unfortunately, Japanese policymakers have a habit of stuffing up recoveries in Japan. In 1995, the Japanese economy looked like it was finally turning the corner, and they raised taxes and raised interest rates, and the economy fell over again. The fact that the Bank of Japan has recently made noises about basically tightening monetary policy, I think, is a real problem. Until the economy is solidly back on its feet, I think they should ease off. I'm not someone who's incredibly optimistic about the Japanese economy, but I think it's looking better than it has in the past few years. China is the big story, and Ahmed's, again, stolen my thunder on this one, but I agree with Ahmed entirely that if you look over a 10 to 20 to 30-year horizon, I can see China continuing to grow at the 8 to 10% GDP growth rates that we've seen over the last decade or more. There are a number of reasons for that. Other economies have been able to do that. Japan and Korea, they've been able to grow at 10% rates or 8 to 10% rates for a number of years. China, I think, is reforming its economy in the right way in the financial markets and other areas where they do have problems. But fundamentally, it's an economy with people who are very motivated and well-educated and getting better educated, and there's no reason why they can't continue to grow at this 9 to 10% rate that they've been growing over the past few years. So on the growth front, I see China as it will have hiccups, but I see it as being a big positive for this part of the world and for commodities producers for many years to come. Of course, the tension politically between the US and China is all around the exchange rate. The exchange rate moved from 8.28 yuan to 8.11 yuan per US dollar last July 21st. And the Chinese government announced that they would allow the exchange rate to be more flexible at that time. And this, the Treasury Secretary from the US had been putting a lot of pressure on China to reform their exchange rate. And he sort of thought this was a step in the right direction and that they would continue to allow their currency to revalue. Since that date, the yuan has only appreciated by about less than 1%. So the exchange rate hasn't moved very far. The US are saying that this is keeping China competitive and that this is enabling them to do all this exporting, and this is the reason why the US has this big trade deficit with China, bilateral trade deficit. The fact is that exchange rate could go to 20 and China would still be very competitive. So it's not the story behind the sort of US lack of competitiveness in manufacturing and the US trade deficit. The fact is if the exchange rate did go to 20, other countries would export to China. So it's almost nothing to do with the US trade deficit. Having said that, I would expect to see further revaluations of the Chinese currency or appreciations over the coming 12 months. There's a great saying that I like to quote from Deng Xiaoping when they started the reform process in 1979, which is, we will reform our economy as if we are crossing the river, feeling the pebbles under our feet. And this has been the whole Chinese approach to reform over the past 25 years, doing it very slowly at its own pace, but trying to get it right. And if you think about what that means for the exchange rate, they will continue to reform their exchange market. You'll have slow and steady reform to financial markets more generally, and a slow and steady appreciation so that they can manage the economy. So the sort of number that I would expect to see would be sort of 2 to 3% appreciation through 2006. We're not going to see, I don't think, a 10% revaluation this year. 10% might occur over 5 years, two or three years, but not in 12 months. Just let me talk quickly about some of the risks to the world economy, and I've focused on three: inflation, US twin deficit situation, and oil prices. Inflation, I've already mentioned, I don't see as a significant problem. And there are a number of reasons for this. Amit did talk about the sort of deflationary effects of China being able to export so much on the manufacturing side very cheaply and at prices that are getting cheaper, exporting deflation or low inflation. I think the other thing to remember is that in the Australian economy, we've now had 20 years of reforms, reforms to product and labour markets that essentially make it much more difficult for unions to ask for large wage increases, for producers to pass along wage increases into prices, or for producers to exploit monopolistic power to raise prices. The bottom line from reform to the Australian economy, and reforms that have also occurred in many other economies globally, is that I just don't think there's the ability to generate inflation that was evident 20 to 25 years ago. We've also had an economy that's been having very strong productivity growth, and that also puts downward pressure on inflation and prices. And I could speak more about that, but the bottom line is I don't see any risk to inflation in the sort of forecast horizon of 2 to 3 years. And even if the Treasurer were to cut taxes generally, I don't think that that's a risk to inflation as much as perhaps the Reserve Bank might say the things that Ahmed was alluding to earlier. I still don't think there's a problem there with potential inflation as a result of tax cuts. What about the US twin deficits? I think the real risk here is sort of political type of risk. There's risk that the US will turn more inward. There's already been many sort of protectionist bills brought to the US Congress and so on, trying to protect the US economy from unfair Chinese and other competition. And I think that's the real risk to the world economy from the US twin deficits. I have to say the major risk from the US budget and trade deficits are to the US economy and not so much to the world economy. The world impact on the world economy and therefore Australia would mainly come through these sorts of channels of trade wars and political disputes between the US and China over the value of the yuan. What about oil prices? Something that we haven't spoken about today. I, again, don't see rising oil prices as a major risk to the world economy. Essentially what happened with the 70s and 80s oil price rises was that oil prices rose, central banks raised interest rates because they were worried about inflation. There's a number of well-known papers by James Hamilton from San Diego University in the US arguing that the real problem with oil prices in the past has been that it led to tighter monetary policy because people feared inflation. Given that that oil price rises now lead to relative prices but not generalised price increases, I don't think we haven't seen monetary tightening as a result of those oil price rises in the past couple of years. Therefore, we're not going to have as damaging an effect on the economy as we had historically from rising oil prices. So we're not going to have the inflation effect. We're not going to have the damaging effect on the local economy. So rising oil prices have been leading to changes in relative prices. That's why the headline inflation rate is higher than the core inflation rate. But they haven't been leading to generalised inflation. And that's also because oil is a much less important part of the economy than 2010, 20 and 30 years ago. And the only obvious exception is things like the airline industry, where it is still an important part of costs. The bottom line for inflation and oil price risks is that as long as we continue to reform the economy and encourage competition, I don't see that inflation or rising oil prices are a risk to the Australian economy. So let me conclude on that note, and I'm not sure if we're taking questions straight away or after, but I'm happy to take questions after the main course. My bottom line here is that I see another solid year for the Australian economy in 2006, and we are in an economy that's on a very solid footing. China is the big international story. Despite saying that there's risks to the US economy, it's no longer the sort of unilateral driving force behind global GDP growth.
There are now a number of drivers, US, China, hopefully Japan again, as well as possibly Europe. As I've said there, it's the unknown risks to watch out for. I think Armin's point was right. There are always risks, and the reason economists can't forecast where the economy is going all the time is because there are things that come out of the blue, bird flu being the obvious one, that are extremely difficult to or impossible to predict. So it's the unknown risks to watch for. Thank you.